Hello, my name is Courtney Ledford. I am a rising junior at Portland State University. For the past 8 weeks, I have been a part of the ELT-RU Computational Modeling Program offered by Dr. Christoph Tischer and have been working with Dr. Joe Fusion as my faculty advisor. My project is on predicting the efficacy of psilocybin in treating mental health and addiction through the use of machine learning, a random forest classification model is used. This model intended to see if the model could predict if the experimental study involved healthy participants or participants with a DSM diagnosis. I will refer to these experiments with participants diagnosed with a mental disorder as the clinical experiments versus the healthy experiments. To get started, a brief introduction to what psilocybin is. It is a psychoactive compound found in fungi. Upon ingestion, the psilocybin is converted to psilocin, which binds to serotonin receptors. This is what causes individuals to undergo an altered state of consciousness or hallucinations. Psilocybin was first synthesized in 1958 and marketed and sold for research purposes as indocybin. Throughout this time and until now, this psychoactive compound, psilocybin, has been researched to aid in treating mental health and addiction. The data was pulled from the Altered States database and from the 31 experiments chosen to predict if the random forest could differentiate between a healthy experiment or clinical. All of these experiments contain results from five subjective questionnaires to assess consciousness. The participants filled out these questionnaires after the administration of psilocybin. My model focuses on the five-dimensional altered states of consciousness, the 5D-ASC questionnaire. It is composed of 94 questions on a sliding yes or no scale and is broken down into five dimensions, categorized as auditory alterations, dread of ego dissolution, oceanic boundlessness, vigilance reduction, and visionary restructuralization. These subjective responses result in the values inputted into the model. Due to the legality of psilocybin being classified as a Schedule I drug, this has limited the number of research experiments that have been conducted. There are a couple of studies that perform a meta-analysis on past psilocybin administrations to healthy participants. I am more so interested in seeing how psilocybin affects participants who have been diagnosed with a mental disorder. For instance, my model included four clinical experiments involving patients with a diagnosis of obsessive-compulsive disorder, OCD, alcohol dependency, and two studies involving anxiety induced by a cancer diagnosis. A limitation of my model is it is biased towards healthy participants, as I compared 31 experiments and only four of those included the clinical experiments. This is where a random forest machine learning algorithm is used to make these predictions. As there are several variables to compare within the small sample size of the 31 analyzed experiments, the model created 1,000 decision trees that make up the forest, and as it is a classification model, it works off a majority votes. The dependent variable of this model is whether or not the experiment was classified as healthy or clinical. The values of the five categorized dimensions from this questionnaire will determine if the experiment consisted of healthy or clinical participants. The intent is to continue adding more data and variables to make better predictions as to whether or not an individual may benefit from treatment involving psilocybin. The model was able to predict out of the five categories which variable is the most important in determining if the experiment used clinical participants. From this prediction, oceanic boundlessness was the most important variable, accounting for nearly 25% of the model in making these predictions. Going further into the machine learning process, I'll be interviewing my mentor, Dr. Joe Fusion, who has helped me learn what is required to create a random forest, as well as how machine learning may benefit pharmaceutical research.
Hello, Dr. Joe Fusion. So you are working at Portland State University. If you don't mind having a brief introduction of yourself.
Sure. So I'm an adjunct at Portland State in the System Science Department. I have my PhD is in system science from Portland State. I have a background in computer science before that. I've worked in the industry in computer science as a developer and a software engineer, and I've worked as a data scientist and an analyst and a modeler in different senses. before and after my degrees at PSU. And I teach classes in data science, machine learning, systems theory, artificial life, a few different things here at Portland State.
And how long have you been working in the field?
I've been doing, depending on which field, I've been doing machine learning and data science work since maybe 2004, 2005.
Okay. And you've been helping me, and you've been my mentor in this computational modeling program here at PSU. And in regards to pharmaceutical research, where do you see the field of machine learning going, and what are the benefits of using machine learning?
There's a whole lot. There's a lot going on in pharmaceuticals. It's been one of the promising areas for a while, or area it's got a lot of attention because there's a lot of data. There's a lot of unknowns, a lot of good to be done, a lot of money involved, money to be made or money for research. Some of the main, there are things going on at molecular, pharmaceutical design level of having machine learning predict what molecules might do based on their structure as a sort of a way to guide research, to look at certain molecules. There's a lot of there's work to be done. So like this stuff that you're looking at, I think some of the interesting stuff is in looking at how drugs or how treatments affect people when it's when there's a very, very complex system involved and it's not easy to see just what a drug is doing or just which people are helped by it. This idea of having treatments and drugs tailored to individuals based on their genome or their experience, their particular way a condition presents in them. There's a lot of benefit there, a lot of ways we could improve, dealing with the difficult or long-term conditions, some of the harder problems. So I think there's a lot of potential there for modeling and machine learning to help out.
Okay. And where does neural networks tie into that?
Neural networks are they're one of a number of methods that do a nice job of handling a lot of data, handling a complex system where the goal isn't necessarily to understand exactly how the system works. There are cases where we can't understand everything about how a system works, but we know that we can learn some of its structure, we can learn the patterns, and make some predictions, get some understanding out of it. Neural networks, part of the principle of them is that we know that human brains are pretty good at some of this pattern finding. Brains in general are good at it, so we've designed algorithms that act like brains and are different in certain ways and can be fed a whole lot of data, can be experimented with in different ways. And neural networks have a big push behind them in technology and in the tools available and the research done for a number of different fields. So it makes it kind of exciting to apply neural networks to a new problem because people are doing so much with it that you've got a lot of tools and a lot of excitement available around it.
Okay. And then going into the model we were working on, as the data was limited to a small sample size of 31 experiments, what are the advantages of using a random forest compared to other machine learning models?
What I say specifically about having a small amount of data, if you the kind of standard ways to get a significant result or something you're really confident in with a small amount of data, you're going to get a very simple model. Like if you approach that model with linear regression, you'll get a pretty good model of it, sort of, that is kind of simple and conservative, kind of safe in what it does to get you a significant response. If we use something like the random forest, or a bigger sort of more robust model, maybe if we used like a multivariate regression, or we used a neural network, or we use something else, we may not get as much. We're not going to get as much significance or confidence maybe in the result. But what we can get is an idea of how complex the system might be, or if there are more interactions among the variables, if there are nonlinear relations, if there are different kinds of complexity in it, we'll get an idea of what might be there, and then that maybe drives a hypothesis or for what you might get if you got more data, like what you might look for, or how you might model this, what other questions you might ask in the future.
Okay. And what were some of the biggest disadvantages working with the limited data set for our random forest?
Well, the one challenge is that we really like to, so besides significance, like I was talking about, of confidence in your results, we like to do these kinds of methods. We'd like to have enough data that we split it up into a training and test split. So we use most of the data to train our model, so that the model learns everything in the training set. Maybe that's 80% of your data. And in most methods, typically, like, the method can get really, really good at the training data. And then once it's trained to some, as long as we want to train or to some performance level, then we give it the test data to look at and see, is it actually that good? Does it generalize to data that it hasn't seen before? So that's a nice part of the process that we typically do. And so we didn't do that step with this limited amount of data. And the other issue here is that, and this could be an issue with larger data sets as well, but the issue here is that these 31 samples were biased in this variable we're interested in, of what kind of subjects were used in it. This was a binary variable, and only 4 of those 31 samples had one of the values, and 27 had the other. Mm-hmm. So in those cases, it can be your machine learning method might pick up on some quirk in the data to separate those 4 from the others, instead of finding the real pattern that we're interested in. Hopefully with the random network, maybe it does a little better than some in not getting caught up on quirks in the data, since it's sampling our 31 samples in different subsets.
And so right now we currently have the variable importance that you found through the random forest, through the data sets. What other information can we learn from these 31 experiments from this model?
Let's see. So we did this prediction of looking at the aggregate survey results from these studies, and said, can the survey results, tell us whether they were the study used healthy patients or patients who are being clinically treated? And it was able to separate them. And then we looked at how it did that, and that gave us this importance of the variables. So which variables were used most often in the decision trees in the random forest. So we could, there are some other things we could get, from that same random forest, perhaps, of looking at, how would I say this? Looking at the importance of the variables maybe in different ways, or looking at which variables made the decision, were involved in more decisions, or we might look at particular cases from the 31, from our 31 rows, like taking one case and running it through the random forest and seeing how particular decisions are made. But there's the maybe more to be done in taking that data and training a different, training another random forest on it, or some other method, but doing another machine learning method to ask a different question of it, where there were, so as well as survey responses, there are other variables in this data set for parameters of the study design, such as how long after treatment until the questions were asked, or the dosage used of the treatment, whether there was another treatment used at the same time. so seeing whether any of those maybe predicted survey responses could be interesting. Seeing what other patterns, what other connections are in the data. There's a number of different questions you could ask just in that, even in that small set.
So the ability to ask different questions and train the model on different questions asked, would you still recommend continuing using the random forest? Or at this point, looking at the data, do you have another machine learning method in mind?
I think the random forest is nice for sure. And it does, it has this built in, the fact that it's making a bunch of decision trees based on different subsets of the data is a very nice built-in thing to the method. With some other methods, other algorithms, you can do that. You do some sort of bootstrapping or something, but it's kind of an extra step, and maybe you do it or you don't. But it's kind of a core to the random forest, and that's very nice. One of the things that I would do, typically working with data like this, is I would start with really simple methods at first. I would do, just do the linear regression, look at correlations between variables. And we did some visualizations. You did some visualizations of the data at the start, which is, some of the first steps I would do. Just to understand, you want to know if there's a really obvious correlation between some variables, and then you expect that those are a little bit conflated, or maybe you need to drop one or something. But you want to get a baseline of how good can I do with a linear regression or a logistic regression or something? Because you want the random forest to do better than that in some way, either to find something different or to get better performance or something. So what I might do is go back and do some of the simpler methods or spend more time with those. And then there are some other methods you could apply to this. This is I wouldn't necessarily use a neural network with this small amount of data, because I would expect it to train perfectly on it, just like the random forest did, but then there wouldn't be as much sort of inspection that I could do of the results. Like we're talking about this variable importance and so on. I wouldn't get as much out of a neural network maybe, or anything different than that. So a thing that might be interesting would be to do some sort of clustering analysis, which would be, so instead of asking, we've been talking about questions in the form of what do these, X many variables say, these input variables say about one other variable. Mm-hmm. So we're asking this predictive or classification question, maybe. A clustering method doesn't have that dependent variable that you're asking about. Instead, you would be saying, based on these variables, which of the samples are similar to each other and in what way? And that might give you, so if we did a clustering analysis of these, it might say these 7 studies were similar to each other, and these 12 were similar to each other, and these other 5 were similar to each other, and the others were not really similar to any of them. And you'd get this sort of diagram of the clusters of them and how close they are to each other in a sense. And that gives you a very different picture of what's going on between them, potentially.
Well, thank you for answering my questions and for all your assistance throughout this project. It's been a great learning experience.
Sure, it's been really fun.
Thank you.
The second interview will be with Dr. Aylin Ledford, who has experience working with patients and prescribing medications for individuals suffering from poor mental health. As he is on the front line of working with patients, it is important to know more about the current treatments and their potential for abuse, and where psilocybin therapy may fit into this. Hello, Dr. Aylin Ledford. Thank you for joining me today for this podcast discussing the efficacy in using psilocybin in treating mental health and addiction. Do you mind giving us a brief introduction to your experience working in the Navy as a doctor, as well as in Nome, Alaska, in the emergency room?
Okay. My name is Dr. Aylin Ledford. I'm an MD. Went to John A. Barron School of Medicine and did residency at the Camp Lejeune in North Carolina. Got the military scholarship. They paid for my way to medical school. Did my time in the Navy with the Marines. Then when I got out of the Navy, I went to Alaska and have been there in the emergency room for approximately 12 years, working in the emergency room there as well as the inpatient. Then I returned back home to Hawaii, where I'm currently working in an outpatient clinic, my own outpatient clinic.
So you worked with a wide range of population groups, and you've been practicing medicine since 2004. Can you briefly describe your experiences prescribing medications while working in the ER, or what is the process when a patient comes in and is having a difficult experience with their mental health?
Okay, so it all varies depending on what condition you have versus, you know, depression, anxiety, PTSD, or schizophrenia type of disorders. Or even alcoholism and drug abuse, altered mental status, things like that. So basically, when they come in, we do an assessment. I typically get a urine drug screen and an alcohol level to see if they're on any mind-altering substances that could lead to depression, anxiety, trigger PTSD, or even kick off a schizoaffective disorder. Based off of that, if those come back and they're normal, then, you know, my thought process is, okay, you know, if they're acting bizarre, could this be a schizoaffective disorder? Now, I'm limited in the emergency room because I usually don't have the patient's full medical history, nor do I have their psychiatric history. So I do not diagnose schizophrenia if they're acting bizarre or strange. I'll diagnose schizoaffective disorder because, again, I don't know if this is just a psychotic break that the patient is having or what. In those cases, yes, I do prescribe medications, and I have them follow up with their primary care provider within, you know, the next 2 to 3 days so that they can get seen, hopefully, by their specialist or psychiatrist or their primary care provider that could, you know, further elucidate the cause and or continue with their treatment period. And when they come in for, let's say, anxiety, depression, obviously we try to get down to what's going on by whether it's depression, anxiety, PTSD, and we go that way, in that direction. As far as giving medications for anxiety and depression, I do give medications from the emergency room if the patient hasn't already been on medications. And even if they have been on medications to calm them down, I usually will give a benzodiazepine, usually a short-acting in the emergency room, as well as a long-acting in the emergency room. That way I can get the patient calmed down and relaxed, and then be able to talk to them more in-depthly or call the psychiatrist to come down and take a look at the patient. But yeah, in the emergency room, like, my main goal is to address the emergent situation and get quick resolutions so that we can resolve the bigger problem at hand.
Thank you. And how would you... I'm sorry?
Go ahead.
And how would you...
In the outpatient setting... Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry. In the outpatient setting, it's a little different. I've only been working outpatient for the past year and a few months. So the process in the outpatient setting, being the primary care provider now, is a little different. I'm more apt to put them on an SSRI or any type of MAO inhibitors. I'll do that in the office setting, in the outpatient setting, just because I should have more follow-up and it should be easier for me to do that. But again, my majority of my experience is in the emergency room, where I don't have enough data and I can only go based off what I'm seeing in a 15-minute period, basically.
So what would you use for your patients that need long-term assistance with these diagnoses related to anxiety, okay, depression?
Being that I'm an emergency room doctor, anything long-term that has to be deferred to their primary care provider and maybe even a specialist if the primary doesn't feel comfortable tackling that on. Now that I'm working in primary care, I do prescribe medications for people that need it, but I also want them to do counseling, because basically these medications that we give, they're just a bridge. They're not the cure for any of these ailments. It's just a means to help the patient get to a cure. Really, the medications, in my opinion, they're not the cure. The cure is within the patient. Finding what's causing the depression, finding what's causing the anxiety or PTSD, and addressing those issues and learning how to better cope with that situation, whether the offending agent of their depression and PTSD is completely removed, or they learn techniques to better cope with their feelings and thoughts when they creep up in the middle of the night.
As psilocybin is... No, I'm sorry, continue.
I'm sorry. I really believe that, you know, physical exercise is key. People got to be moving. People got to be sweating. And in my opinion, I think if, you know, eat healthy diet, heavy exercise, workout, run, do sports, do something, and I think that can really help with a lot of the depression, anxiety, and PTSD issues.
As psilocybin is being studied as a treatment for mental health and addiction, can you talk briefly about the current medications, as you mentioned, benzodiazepines? How is that related to addiction?
So it depends on the benzodiazepines. Like I had mentioned earlier, in the emergency room setting, I do use a quick-acting benzodiazepine. Everybody's familiar with Xanax. Everybody knows that. It's highly abused. So the shorter the acting benzodiazepine, or the faster the acting the medication is, usually the more addictive it is. So, yes, Xanax is highly addictive. And do I use it in the emergency room? Yes, I do. But do I send the patient home with a prescription of that? No, I don't. I actually change them over to a long-acting benzodiazepine, such as Klonopin. Now, Klonopin is also highly addictive. Any type of, let's say, mind-altering substance can be highly addictive. So any of the benzodiazepines are highly addictive. the longer acting are less addictive. And this is where the patient will need, you know, to see their physician, see a counselor. Again, if we can get people off these medications and just be able to cope better coping mechanisms, whether it's exercise or work or whatever, the better it would be for them.
So on that note, how would you feel about a new medication such as psilocybin and including your patients in a clinical treatment study?
So I have heard of psilocybin. It's been around 50s, 60s. Not a lot of research has gone into it. Me personally, for my patients, I think anything that could give hope to a patient is better than nothing. I think hope for patients that have no hope with anxiety, depression, PTSD, I think hope is key to help these patients to get better. So would I be interested in a clinical trial for my patients? Absolutely. I'd ask my patients if they'd be interested, and I would definitely would participate if my patients were willing to do something like this.
Well, thank you for answering all my questions. It was a pleasure interviewing you, Dr. Ledford.
No problem. Glad I could help.
As psilocybin continues to be researched as an alternative treatment, individuals must be thoroughly assessed prior to being involved in these studies. Machine learning provides an option to create predictions based on the available data to best prepare future research, as well as determining if an individual may be a good candidate for this therapy. Mental health is an issue that every community faces. Predicting the efficacy of psilocybin through the use of machine learning will benefit future therapies and overall health of individuals. Thank you for joining me in this discussion on using machine learning to predict the efficacy of psilocybin as a mental health and addiction treatment.